This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to Mr. Harry Bucknell, Nick Hunt and Tom Cheshire, everybody. Have a seat, gentlemen. Over to you.
Well, welcome, everybody. We're going to talk about the two books that have been written here, walking books. One by Harry Bucknell, who went from St. Paul's Cathedral all the way to Rome on foot, which was a journey of 1,411 miles precisely, which was quite a feat. And we have Nick Hunt here, who followed in the footsteps of Patrick Lee Fermor, who in 1933 walked from the Hook of Holland to Constantinople, and Nick Hunt has followed in his footsteps. So two remarkable feats. And I just before asking them a few questions about their journey, and here are their books, which are very, very well-written books, I was going to just give a little introduction about each of them and give you a flavour of their books in case you're interested in buying them and or if you're just interested in knowing about them. So first of all, Nick Hunt was inspired by Patrick Lee Fermor, who wrote the book in 1930, well, travelled in 1933 from the Hook of Holland to Constantinople. And actually, he was aged 18 at the time, Patrick Lee Fermor, and then subsequently, at the age of 62, wrote up his journey in a very entertaining book that was published in 1977 called A Time of Gifts. And so Nick Hunt travelled at age 30, and this was a couple of years ago now. Was it 2011 you went?
The winter of 2011.
Winter of 2011. Yeah. And this is a 2,500 miles altogether?
I don't know. That was quite a rough guess, but as far as I can work it out, yeah.
And so Nick studied English at Literature at the University of East Anglia, and he had lived for some time in Mexico, America, and Spain. And so he'd had an interest in travel and had read Patrick Lee Fermor's book and been inspired by this journey. And so off he went, going from Harwich with a hip flask of whiskey in his pocket. And he soon realised that walking such long distance was quite painful and had terrible shin splints very early on and kind of had to get through the kind of pain process of walking and realised it was not just an easy matter going so many miles. And along the way, he realised there were a few differences to Paddy Lee Fermor's journey. In fact, when in 1933 there were no motor cars, well, very few. And so, in fact, going along these motorways was, you found quite dehumanising in some points and quite brutal and kind of, so your journey was different to his because of the kind of the way life has moved on since then. And Nick is extraordinary in that he slept rough many times, you know, on the edge of old castles and in forests and old farmers' huts, and you know, almost fingers almost dropped off at one point. It was so cold, freezing environment. And anyway, he's made his way all the way along, feeling a bit like a tramp at times, and eventually reaching Istanbul.
Istanbul.
And so it's and along the way, it's a lovely book because you hear the quotes of Patrick Lee Fermor along the way, and you kind of, so he interweaves his story with Patrick Lee Fermor, so you learn about that journey of 1933 and also Nick's updated version. Now, Harry was equally, didn't go quite as far.
No.
So it's slightly fewer miles. So whereas this was 2,500 miles.
It's 1,100 less. I took the easy route.
You took 94 days, 1,411 miles from St. Paul's Cathedral through England, France, Switzerland, Italy, and on to ending in Rome. Now, this was an ancient pilgrim's route known as the Via Francigna.
The Via Francigna. Which is a wonderful piece of Italian marketing to make it easy pronounceable name. It's otherwise known as the Frankish Way.
Yes, and so it went along the way. And now what happens when you do this as a proper pilgrimage? you have to apply to the, now tell me the exact name.
The Confraternity of Pilgrims to Rome. It's a whole load of, whole raft of easy to remember names here that I'm going to throw out at you from time to time during this talk. The Confraternity, the guys who technically run the route.
Yeah, and so you're given a pilgrim's pass, and everywhere you go, you're given a stamp along the way. And many of the hostels will put you up for a euro or nothing along the way. So this, and at the moment, fewer than a handful of people from Britain actually could do this route each year. So Harry was, you know, very adventurous. Very adventurous. Now, the first person ever to... Britain ever recorded, or English person ever recorded to make this walk, was St. Wilfrid of Hexham.
Yeah.
And that was in the 7th century. And then King Alfred the Great and King Canute, but also did the walk. And by 1450, 40,000 people every year were going along this route that very few people have heard of. I mean, people know about the Santiago de Compostela.
Santiago route.
And so that's famous, but this one is not so well known. Now, Harry is amazing that he actually sent the book to Patrick Lee Fermor, who died in 2011.
Which I never did.
And has a quote on the cover saying, "This is a lovely book." So Patrick Lee Fermor has endorsed
I killed him, actually, because he died a week later. But anyway,
there's a Patrick Lee Fermor link of sorts. And Jan Morris, the famous travel writer, said she enjoyed his laid-back writing style. So the two.
I didn't kill Jan Morris, but I'm working on it.
Jan Morris is still alive. And so there were two very good endorsements. And now Harry was his background is that he was a soldier in the Coldstream Guards for 12 years and also worked as a mining and oil and mining consultant in the Middle East. So he has a very interesting background. And along the way, he was almost flattened by a boulder in the mountains near Switzerland. Literally, a boulder missed him by a matter of meters. He would have died. This is the size of a fridge.
But I didn't.
And thankfully. And suffered blisters, just as Nick Hunt did. Described himself at one point as feeling pathetic, vagrant, exhausted, parched, sunburnt, and wrung out. I've never felt so lonely or so weak. So he had some both these walkers struggled on their journeys in order to write these books that are very enjoyable books. Now, I will not go on anymore, but I will ask them, first of all, one by one, why did you decide to go on your walk for such a long way?
So, do people here know the works of Patrick Lee Fermor, just roughly? It's kind of fairly safe bet with this audience. I read these books when I was 18 years old, the same age that he was when he did this journey in the 1930s. And people that have read the books kind of love or hate his writing style. There's something that gets under your skin. There's something very haunting. He saw what seemed to be the last of a certain world, and of old Europe before the war, before communism in Eastern Europe, before modernization, before motorways, before suburbs. And I was fascinated to see how much of this still survived.
Yeah, well, when he went on his walk, the brown shirts were on the march in Germany.
He saw, rise of the Nazis. He heard mutterings of change.
Yeah, and when you read this when you were 18, what was it about his writing style that captivated you? Because he was quite a privileged person. He kind of stayed at he was from a well-to-do background, and he stayed at these country houses along the way. He's not an average Joe, was he?
He wasn't, but he was very democratic in his acquaintances. Like he could make friends with anyone, and his writing really sums up this kind of wonderful sense of freedom. Yeah. And I think the way we think about Europe today is we have a tendency to think of it as being homogenized, as being slightly dangerous, as being dull. And that was what I wanted to find out, how much of the world that he saw has lasted to our own time.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting way of looking at it. And why, Harry, did you decide to go to Rome?
Well, Tom, I didn't decide. It was decided for me. I had just finished my first book, and I was sitting back thinking how wonderful it was to write this book, and because I'd never written a book before. And up the valley came this enormous, dirty, great black cloud, and it sat over the house, and then out of which came torrents of rain, and followed by the most enormous thunderbolt. And I just watched this. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Until suddenly the thunderbolt turned the whole house blue, and I watched in horror as the cable which connects my laptop to the rest of the outside world glowed blue. A little spark hit the side of the laptop. A puff of smoke went up in the roof, and my laptop went black. And I went, oh, shit, 88,000 words just gone up in a puff of smoke. So what do you do, laugh or cry? I went downstairs to make myself a cup of coffee. And while I was waiting for the kettle to boil, I started to read the newspaper. And I opened the first page of the newspaper, which was on the kitchen table, and there was a huge map of the Via Francigena, the Frankish Way, and I went, there's the next book. Now, if you analyze that in real terms, short of the heavenly host appearing in my sitting room, there was really little other way that God could say to me, guess where you're going next? And so that's how I ended up going to Rome. Yeah. No, I didn't want to go. I'm the most unlikely pilgrim, but off I was sent.
Yeah, but it was a very strange series of events, really.
Nothing in my life is ever normal.
So, now, ask you, what was your best moment? When you realised, I'm glad I made this trip, that it all fits, this makes sense?
So one moment that stands out is after about 4 or 5 months walking, finding myself at the top of a mountain called Retezat in Romania, and this was the first time I'd really kind of experienced true wilderness, I think.
Right.
I'd been walking on the edges of roads and suburbs and towns for a long time, but this involved very amateur and ill-considered mountain climbing,
yeah.
As in finding myself going up and up and up through the snow.
Yes.
And there comes a point where you can't really go down because it's too slippy to go backwards. Mm-hmm. So I kept on going up and just found myself on this point where I could see almost like the two halves of the journey. And behind me was the green world that I just left that led all the way back to the Hook of Holland.
Yeah.
And in front of me were mountains.
Yeah.
And beyond that, Bulgaria, and beyond that, Turkey. And it was just one of those rare moments when you actually have a point of clarity. And I could almost see my journey going backwards along sides of motorways and taking shortcuts through McDonald's drive-throughs and petrol station forecourts.
Was
and then reaching this point of absolute solitude.
Was there one point you almost turned off and there was a big drop, like a lift shaft or something? You said you almost lost your life if you'd gone a few yards further.
Well, yeah, there was there's quite a wonderful sense of terror when you think that there's actually nothing between me and...
It was actually scary reading that passage because he really put his life on the line, I think. But did you have a favourite place that you visited? Was there a favourite kind of town or city?
Generally, I just say Romania.
Yeah.
That was the country I fell in love with more than any other.
Right.
And I think partly as a walker, as soon as I crossed the border, I had a sense of ease. And I'm not quite sure why, but it's something to do with the speed of the roads and this horse-drawn traffic. People had just a different sense about them, a sense of more time, more generosity.
Yeah. And I suppose that was the most like Patrick Lee Fermor's visit himself, that there were no fewer cars and actually horse-drawn carriages and so forth.
That was the place that hadn't changed the most, which is kind of amazing because I think they underwent the most brutal social change since he walked, but somehow they weathered that storm, and there's a still very deep, proud peasant culture and a sense of attachment to the land, which I didn't really find anywhere else.
Okay, that's interesting. So, and now yourself, Harry, was there a moment that kind of stood out for you where you kind of...
Yes, I suppose I should say really that the moment that stood out for me was arriving in Rome, and that would make sense seeing as the book was about walking to Rome. But actually, the moment that really caught me unawares was when I hit the Mediterranean Sea. I didn't hit it literally, but we had this dreadful day climbing through the Apennine Mountains, and in terms of severity, the Alps actually are a far harder climb. But actually, in terms of sheer physical fillets and sheer gradient of climb, the Apennines were simply horrendous. These great sort of spikes that stick up through the Italian landscape. We had been climbing up, and we'd made some I was at this stage traveling with a Swiss teacher, and we'd made dreadful progress that day. The heat was about 42, 43 degrees. We were very low on water. Sometimes we were crawling, it was so steep. And we got to the top and we collapsed about half an hour at the top. And this was about day 80, day 82 along the journey. So by now you were very just worn down by the whole process of the journey itself, cumulative effect taking place. And we then crested the ridge and we went down a little ridge line, a spur, for about 200 yards. And suddenly we were in a sort of, you know, a bough of a tree just lifted the wind. And ahead of me, about 10, 15 miles on the coast, were two very prominent hills that lifted up. And to my mind, there was a little faint line going across between these two hills. And I looked at it and I thought, there's a line. It could have been a telegraph line. It was that faint. And suddenly I saw a speedboat arc through the bottom half of that line. And I realized that was the sea. And to me, it was a really pagan moment. But to arrive on the coast, having walked the best part by then of, I don't know, 1,200 miles, to think how a pilgrim in the Middle Ages or earlier would have thought of that, to walk all that way. And you just come away and you think, my God, that was quite remarkable that anybody could have done that. And that was what really, for me, was the most special moment.
Yeah. Did you have a worse moment? Was there a kind of time when you felt, I'm just going to go get an easy jet and fly home? Or?
Undoubtedly. There was a day at about week three, so day 21, and we should by now be really cracking down the range as far as it was concerned. And I got to the beautiful cathedral town of Lyon, and and that day I think I'd done about 29, 30 miles, and something had gone badly wrong. I'd run out of water. I had my boots were giving me terrible pains. I had shin splints. I had blisters, and I struggled into the town like a sort of pathetic vagrant. And I got to the shower, and in the shower in the hotel, I was staying in this mildew-ridden B&B, in case you get ideas of sort of the Lyon Four Seasons or whatever. And I got in there, and I burst into tears, and I crumbled into a ball in the floor. For an army officer to do that, to admit such defeat, is almost incomprehensible. I was staring defeat in the face. And for me, it wasn't about the love of God. It wasn't about the love of my regiment, the love of my family. It was the fear of God, the fear of failure, the fear of coming back and saying, oh, I didn't like it, you know, I got 3 weeks on the way to Rome, and I'm back. And they'd say, you? So that, for me, was a formative moment, and it was a real low point, because I got myself into this mess, and I had to get myself out of it, and there was only one way to get out of it, and that was to walk the next 1,200 miles to Rome. So that, for me, was a big decision point.
How many miles did you walk each day? Roughly.
It varied. Yeah. On a good day, about 35 miles, on a really good day. On a bad day, if it had been a good night the night before, maybe 5 or 10. It just depended really on the quality of the Chianti.
How many miles, Nick, did you walk per day?
About the same. It got slower and slower.
Miles.
It got slower the more hospitable people got. And by the time I got into Eastern Europe, it was the question changed. At first, people I stayed with would say, when do you have to leave? Which is a perfectly reasonable question. And then later on, they started to say, how long can you stay? Right. And that was the point at which this kind of the pivot shifted. So I slowed down the further I got.
Yeah. And did you... So you were 221 days. That was the
221 that was the days.
And did you, you have a very low... Were you stuck in a field freezing at any point? What was your lowest point? Was that it?
No, stuck in the field freezing. I was in a hunting hide, which is kind of things on stilts in the middle of Austria in the snow.
Yeah.
And that was, it was quite exhilarating in a funny way, being that cold. I'd never experienced actually feeling like I was on the point of
well, I did feel
dying.
Like fingers might drop off or something.
No, that was, I wouldn't say that was my lowest point.
Yeah.
Getting injured in the suburbs in Germany was about the most depressing because there's nothing glorious about it. You know, you're not about to fall off a mountain or freeze to death romantically in the middle of the snowy pine woods.
Right.
You're just limping past a supermarket, feeling like a tramp, dressed in a muddy coat with everyone staring at you. Yeah. I think those moments, and there were more than one of them, it's the fear of dullness rather than the fear of kind of romantic, glorious death.
Both of you, your title has tramp within it. Did you really feel like that you were kind of a homeless vagrant?
And people look through you. You just don't exist. You're this sort of, that's that bloke walking to Rome, look at you. And they just drive past and they sort of, and they look at you like you're some... Like a tramp.
But I found it changed people's perception of a walker changes according to where the walker is.
Right.
So I found if you're in the mountains, you've got a rucksack and you're unshaved and you've got a hat.
Yeah.
You have a place in people's minds. They know you're walking. If you're in the middle of a medieval city centre, then you're a tourist. But it's those points of nowhere land when you're in the suburbs, walking through past an industrial estate.
Yeah.
Along a busy road, and people, you can see people's perceptions shift into deep suspicion because you shouldn't be there. There's no reason for you to be there. There's nothing to see.
Yeah.
There's no natural beauty.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think until Versace or Ralph Lauren designs some real good kit for the everyday urban pilgrim, I think that it's going to be cities are always places to be avoided because you really just don't, you look very out of place. And manoeuvring, through the food halls at Harrods in a Bergen and a rucksack really is a very tricky thing to do unless you really know your gentleman's relish from your honeys and so on.
Very good. Now, I was going to ask both of you who your favourite travel writers are or people who've written about walking. Harry, what would...
I think that the canon of travel writing, especially as far as walking is concerned, going back to the issue about why did I go and do it, I knew I had to write a book about... to be sort of taken seriously, I had to write a book about walking. So, I mean, Laurie Lee's one would come to mind, but I think for me, the person whose particular book I really use as a sort of as an educational tool as much as anything else is Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods. Because one of the things about walking is that you can walk for many, 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 many miles, and I could write to you and say, every day I did the same thing for about 3 weeks, and actually nothing really happens. But when you read Bill Bryson's book about walking in the woods, where actually not a lot happens, you realize then how he creates the story, brings it to life with history, and makes that all part of the whole woven tale. And that's the key thing for me about it, is how you tell the story of the walk and the greater elements of the walk rather than just the walk itself.
Yeah, anybody he meets seems to be an interesting character, doesn't he? Makes it that way. What about yourself, Nick?
Well, I can't feel a duty bound to say Patrick Leigh Fermor. It's also true.
Yeah.
But moving out of his shadow for a second, Nan Shepherd, The Living Mountain. It's Nan Shepherd was this amazing woman who lived in the Cairngorms, and she wrote... It's not really a book. It's more like a love elegy to the spirit of the mountain.
Right.
It's an extraordinary kind of love song to place.
Yeah.
And the other one that springs to mind is it's not strictly about walking, but it's recently come out a book called Consolations of the Forest by Sylvain Tesson.
Oh yeah.
Which is. This French guy who moved into a cabin in the shores of Lake Baikal
for
6 months with nothing but pasta, books, and vodka.
Yes.
And it's an amazing kind of elegy to solitude, more than anything.
I enjoyed that
and,
one
and
too.
And to the Russian soul.
Kind of, he's very comic in the way he sets himself up there in the middle of nowhere.
And he does go for walks. He walks out. Yeah. He decides to visit a friend, which requires getting a sledge and putting some food in it and walking for 5 days across a frozen lake. And then spending a night there and then walking 5 days back.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you about your favourite walks in Britain or elsewhere. But do you have a favourite place in Britain for walking?
Very late discovered the Peak District that I hadn't been to until last year.
Yeah.
And I really fell in love with that landscape. And the Pennine Way, the sense that you see this kind of strange stone-paved path just leading north and knowing that you can walk there and you get to Scotland in 2 weeks.
And when you're walking for fun, not writing about it, how far would you walk each day? What's a good walk for you? When do you feel satisfied?
I feel satisfied when I've got round the next corner.
Right, okay.
But that never ends. I never really feel satisfied, to be honest.
Okay.
Because there's always a bit more you could do, and there's always something that might be over that hill.
So what's around the corner keeps you going. Yeah, and yourself?
I think for me, I live in Dorset, so I'm on a bound really to talk about the Dorset Coast Path, and for me, it's Ballard down above Studland and Swanage, and you get up there and you can see out of White and across the Channel. And for me, walking down that down, you get a great sense of sort of the ancient heritage of our landscape. But on top of that, you look out to sea and there's all the possibilities, the travel, that where would it take you? To the North Sea and beyond up to the Arctic Circle and down, if you look right into the Channel, you're down off to the Mediterranean, all those wonderful lands, all the great Greek islands and Asia Minor and beyond that to the subcontinent and so on. And that to me is where I like to walk. And Tom, to help you with the next question, for me, a walk ends when that pub just comes into the corner in the distance and you say, there we go, that's when the pub ends for me. Yeah, that's when the walk ends. So that's the answer to that one.
That's a good answer.
I'm easily satisfied on a walk.
Right, very good.
It is very easy to be satisfied.
For me.
That's the thing, but it's a simplicity. It reduces the complexity of the world into a very simple, very human act of putting one foot in front of the other. Yeah. It's kind of one of the oldest pleasures there is. And then
the original pleasure.
And then a glass of beer and a bit of cheese or a bit of bread feels extraordinary.
And Nick, do you have any advice for anyone? If you're going on a long walk, are there kind of things you must take into consideration or in terms of the right boot, you know, right boots? Or
well, yeah, get a good pair of boots and don't carry too much. But I'd say, for me, the most important thing is not planning it.
Not what?
Not planning it.
Okay.
And it's not the right thing to say somewhere like this that's dedicated to everything being planned in meticulous detail. Okay. But it takes, and going back to the reason I did it, was to discover that kind of spontaneity that Patrick Leigh Fermor encapsulated so well.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's, you lose that if you know where you're going to sleep each night, if you've got everything booked, if you have deadlines, then you lose that freedom and that looseness.
And Harry, were you as spontaneous as that, or did you?
No, I can't pretend that I've got any of the guts that Nick has in that respect. Yeah. I 12 years sleeping rough in the army at times meant that I was far, and I'm a bit older than Nick, as you can probably tell, meant that I was far more prepared to plan it ahead, actually, and I said bugger to sleeping rough, but my advice for anybody doing a journey like this is to not be daunted by the journey itself. You think, I'm going to walk 1,400 miles. We're not going to walk 1,400 miles in one day. So break it down to bite-sized, achievable pieces, and then it becomes very achievable quite quickly. Because anybody can do these journeys. It's all a question of willpower and saying, right, I'm going to go and do this. And you will find the time, you'll find the money, you'll find the resource, you'll find the way to go and do it. And they are the greatest adventures of all time. These are life-achieving moments, which you just never think are in your grasp and actually really are. So you've just got to seize the nettle and go for it.
And they're simple as well. You don't require special equipment. You don't require special knowledge. You just want to have. You just have to want to do it. And that's
for an army officer, you need to read a map. Sometimes it makes it so easy.
Yeah, you bought lots of maps, didn't you, on your journey?
Yeah, I was festooned with maps. The Italian maps, I'm afraid to say, were the best of the lot because they were about 6 inches wide. And if you're like me and you get distracted and look at a mulberry bush off the left, suddenly you've wandered off the map and you don't know where you are. And it takes a bit of time to get back onto it. But anyway,
what did you do with the maps? I mean, did you discard them or did you post them home to yourself?
You very quickly get into the idea that weight is king. And so paper is the heaviest thing you can carry in any suitcase or whatever, for those of you that travel on business or whatever. So I used to send back regularly the maps or any tourist information I used to pick up. I was picking up stuff regularly. But the one thing I didn't send back at any stage were the notebooks, because the notebooks, I had by the end of it, I had 6 notebooks. These were the gold dust. Lose them and you're completely screwed. but the maps, everything else that could be replaced, all got hoofed back in numbered envelopes, so I knew what was back at home, and that then creates the basis of the book when you come home. This is the sort of carcass of the book when you start to write it out. Yeah. They're very key.
Because Patrick Leigh Fermor lost his notebooks.
He did.
Or one of them. And that
he did. And I lost my notebook on the first day, and that was enough of a symbol to keep it safe.
Yeah.
But I was quite unromantic, I think, about the maps and stuff. I just discarded them as I went. Yeah. And even Patrick Lee Thurmore's books, which I was following, that was my map, really. It was a map from town to town and village to village. Yeah. But those I've received kind of criticism for this from hardcore Paddy fans, but I threw the books in the Danube, between Slovakia and Hungary, and then again in on the edge of Romania.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like I'd finished the map, I'd finished the book, and it seemed like the point of kind of casting them to the waters and letting them go.
Very good. And was there along the way, was there a particular city or place that really surprised you and you enjoyed, you know, that you maybe go back for a weekend break or something? Or, you know,
The city I loved, I think, more than any other was Budapest.
Budapest, okay.
And it was an interesting time, probably even more so now. It's a deeply polarized society and a very poisonous political atmosphere. There's extreme right-wing elements. There's a lot of angry people. But
angry about what?
Well, they have an extremely right-wing government, nationalist government.
Yeah.
They have fascist party marching in the streets in black shirts and flags with runes on them.
Right.
Gosh. And you get this whole kind of liberal anarchist arty scene in Budapest who really feel under siege. They're kind of being pushed out of the city.
Right.
So it did feel like a society that was undergoing this quite existential change.
Right. Well, that's again like Patrick Lee Thurmer's time with the brown shirts in Germany. Did you feel a little bit of that?
Or? Well, I don't want to sort of jump straight to comparisons with 1930s Germany, but seeing that kind of very obvious link back to unreconstructed fascism was interesting. Frightening.
Yeah. And yourself?
I think I'm bound to say that my favourite city to arrive in was Rome, because that to me represented the end of the journey. But it wasn't quite as simple as that, because when I arrived in Rome, I then embarked on an 11-hour lunch. So that really sort of put some sort of flesh on the bones of arriving in Rome and having a really good party. I got thoroughly munted, actually. and I have no problem in saying that. It's in the book, too, so you've got it all there. But there were some very special places. I mean, you think you're going through northern France, you're going through Switzerland, you're going through Italy. When you arrive in Italy itself, it was like landing foot first, the most enormous cocktail party. And I think that Pavia was a wonderful city. There was, or Lucca, but perhaps to my mind, one of the most special places after Rome was Siena, because this was the most amazing city. I liken it, when I'm doing a talk on the book, to arriving in a sort of the Milton Keynes of its day. I mean, it was a wholly contrived, created conurbation, run by its own rules, traditions, with its own city walls, which expanded and expanded. This was the place to live in the Middle Ages. And then, 1347, they decide to build, because they get word that the Florentines, the pesky Florentines, are going to build a larger, greater Duomo than they've got. And for them, Siena is all about pilgrimage. This is the city of the Virgin Mary. And in 1347, as you all know from your history, a small fleet of merchantmen arrived off the coast of Sicily, having made its way from the Crimean shores. By the time it arrived there, half or most of the crews were dead. The Black Death had arrived in Europe. Within a year, 2 years, half of Europe's population, half the known world, was dead. That's greater now than the combined death tolls of the First and Second World War put together. And suddenly Siena came to a grinding halt. So the great Duomo, the Santa Maria dell'Assunta, which was meant to be built to dwarf the Santa Maria del Fiore in Florence, was just simply put to shells, or shelved, rather. And this wonderful city suddenly came to a halt. So when you go to the Duomo now, what you're looking at, in fact, is not this great cathedral. You're looking at a memorial to the Black Death of 1348. And to me, that is the most remarkable city, because the sculptures, the statues, the art, the places to eat, the wines, the views, it is spectacular. But there are hundreds of cities on the way that one could choose on this great route. Yeah. But for me, Siena, I think, is one.
You mentioned some figures in your book about the numbers of deaths during the Black Death. Was it 200 million? Or?
I think 200 million.
That's, I think, yeah.
The world population was 400 million. And we then think, you know, if you take the Ebola crisis now, 3,500 people have been killed by that. Well, that would be a walk in the park for a day in the life of Siena. I mean, you have to imagine that across Europe, the whole structure of society collapsed. Police forces went out of it. The clergy dropped out of the way. everybody, abandon everybody. No one could even bury the dead. Such was this catastrophe that hit Europe at the time.
Okay, and now I wanted to mention a modern travel book about walking. So the Robert McFarlane's The Old Ways, and kind of describing almost like the kind of invisible routes that people kind of existed through the centuries. Now, did you get a feeling of that, Nick, when you feel, obviously you were following in someone's footsteps, but did you feel like these were mystical pathways, or, you know, which seems to be kind of quite a trendy modern way of thinking about walking?
Well, I didn't have the same thing as Harry, is a path that's trodden by many people through history, and it wasn't a recognized route. It was just one man who had done it before. So really the idea of him, without wanting to get too spooky about it, but it was like this kind of path haunted by a previous traveler whose words I was living inside.
Yeah.
So that was what shadowed it for me.
Yeah.
But then there was a sense of just these little clues that people might have left. I didn't meet anyone else walking.
Yeah.
Not anyone. I walked for half a day with someone, but they were just going to the next village. Yeah. But I did find these little kind of monuments of previous travellers that are quite touching.
And Harry, did you get that? I suppose the ghosts of...
The ghosts of Pilgrim's Pass.
Of the Hexham.
Sir Wilfred of Hexham. So, for me, the woods were actually where you really felt this sort of great sense of time. Because you're in these enormous, in France especially, it's 6, 7, 8, 10,000 acre woods, and you suddenly thought this woodland has been here since time immemorial, perhaps since before the start of time as we know it. And for me, it was the bird song, because you then thought that is a continual melody which has gone down through the ages ever since time began, and that really put you back in your little box. It really made you feel like you were swimming at the top of some enormous ocean where you had thousands and thousands of leagues and fathoms below you of water. And indeed, while I was in one of these woods, it was when I don't know, a sprite, a nymph, a dryad, or maybe even Pan himself certainly crossed my path, this spirit figure, who I said, there's a chap up there, I'll go and find out what he's doing. And when I got there, there was no one there. And it was really quite spooky, because there was definitely someone there. I marked him, I could see where he was, and I said, when he comes, let's cross there, I'll find him in that bush over there. And he was nowhere to be seen. And there was definitely a presence about it. And that made the hairs on my right side stand up on end. And that really, for me, signified, or brought the whole thing to life. You thought, goodness, this is something far bigger than I am, far bigger than any of us in this room, and goes back far, far longer. It was those woods where it all came to life.
Okay, so it's a mystical moment. Now, I was going to ask if anybody in the crowd would like to ask questions of the two authors here. Don't know if anyone's got a microphone.
We're ready. Anyone got any questions? Come on, don't be shy. Gentleman over there. There's a mic for you, sir.
Thank you very much. question about planning on a trip like this. Do you do so by, I'm going to do 15 miles today? Do you do it by, there's a bed and breakfast along there and I'll make it to that? Taking what you were saying earlier, Harry, do you do it by pubs?
Well, why do you ask me? I didn't know what your views. My view was you knew what sort of leg you were going to do each day, and you said you want to get to somewhere, and you can take the view if you're going to go. You let's say you're going to do 15 kilometres a day. Let's say you might then find that was an easy walk, and you can then go on beyond that. You never want to fall short of your goal. You always want to go beyond your goal. So it's good. I mean, Nick has a very valid point about walking and just let the journey take you. But there are certain times when you need to get to certain places. I don't know, for picking up post or for new boots or whatever. And it's good to plan in that respect. And it's good to give yourself little goals and say, each day I will aim to do 15 kilometres. Some days you have blisters, the likes of which you didn't even know existed, and you simply can't walk, or you get a knee injury, or like I fell off a tractor rut, about a 2-inch tractor rut, and sustained a 3-month ankle injury after that. Pathetic. But these things happen. So your walk will be tailored physically, and also by your own mental, you sometimes lose the will to do it. You've got to keep going. I think you find that, Nick, didn't you?
Yeah, I think my advice is kind of hopelessly impractical, because I was following a certain path, and I had certain, those made sense to get to about 20-mile stretches where there were villages that I could stay in. But then if I fell short of that or wanted to walk on, I had a tent or I slept out. So I kind of had a way of improvising. And I found something, a good way of doing it was to have the... I was often relying on the hospitality of strangers or, you know, hoping to find it. But having the means to sleep myself in a tent beyond the village meant that I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't asking for it. So you come from a position of kind of, you're not begging.
I think I might just add, one of the things that Nix has brought up there, which is really key, is the kindness of strangers. And through both our routes, you'll find people will go out of their way to help you. When they know who you are, what you're doing, they'll go out of their way to help you. And you are just at times, it's such a reaffirming experience doing a walk of this length, because people are so kind and so helpful to you, and they'll go out of their way to help you. That's a very key point to bring out.
Good point. Any more questions? Gentleman over there. Oh, a lovely microphone. Oh, you'll be next. The lady will go first. Okay.
Hi. Your journey would have been different with the TV crew with you? With the TV program following you?
Oh, no, that would have been awful. Got someone like walking behind you with a camera.
Yeah.
No. I think for me that would have changed the entire feeling of it, because you have to plan everything. People, you know, I'd imagine you have to walk down the same stretch of road 15 times looking in a slightly different direction to get a good shot. And also I think for meeting people, it'd be very hard to meet someone on a genuine level if it's being set up and filmed.
I think also there's a certain immediacy which television gives you. And actually, the BBC looked at trying to do the Rome journey that I did, and we all concluded it was virtually impossible to do, you know, to get that spontaneity. And I think, don't forget that that when you read the book, you're reading a story. And the real journey, at times, was very different from what's in that book. But that's not to say that one has lied about that. It is to say that you want to convey the sense of journey. And at times, Nick had the saying, there were some very dark and very bleak moments. And you try and convey that. But if you get that captured on camera, you're not always at your best. And you know, you might just not want to have them around. And as Nick also points out, the solitude is a very, very key aspect of the walk. And if you're denied that through a television crew saying, okay, Harry, we're going to take that one again now, and you come up, you know, you come up the main road into Bolsena five times because you didn't quite get it right or whatever, or the sun was in the wrong area, that's going to ruin the story for real.
And also, we're trying to sell books as well.
So, yeah, we're in the business of selling books.
Hi. I wanted to ask about how you go about taking notes on when you're actually walking. So do you kind of stop as you go and take notes as you go, and that could become very time-consuming and take up too much of your time, or do you meticulously write your notes at the end of each day, or what's the kind of process behind that?
I just had notebooks and stopped, I mean, kind of every 10 minutes for some stretches, like got quite obsessive with everything, and then the process of writing the book was more a process of stripping out layers of information that was no longer interesting at all. But I think there's it's kind of hard to describe just the level of detail you become aware of when you're walking. And looking back even after one day or half a day, I think I would have forgotten most of it because you have so much coming in all the time and very small incremental changes. So I just wrote down and my writing got smaller and smaller and smaller. And there were points of standing in the snow in Bavaria, scraping my pen and the ink starting to not freeze but run sluggish so it wouldn't come out properly. Standing in the rain with raindrops falling on the page. But it became very important to the purpose of what I was doing, I think. It was what took me from one place to the next.
I think that the moment you set off from your start point until you arrive at the other end, all you're thinking about 24 hours a day is that book. And there are times... You know, Nick and I, when we write, the spooky thing, we're almost like brothers in that respect, is that our writing methods are exactly, almost identical. So this idea of you'll remember it and commit it to paper at the end of the day, you don't. Because catchphrases, whole sentences, whole paragraphs, whole passages come into your mind and you just have to bang it down on the note page there and then. So I always have my notebook in a cargo pocket here. And the notebooks, as I said, they are gold dust. But for the entire journey, all you're thinking about is composing that book. What's going to make this a really good book that your publisher will want to be able to sell? And that's what it comes down to at the end of the day.
Brilliant questions. Unfortunately, I think that's going to have to be it now, gentlemen.
How about last one over there? Lovely lady in blue.
Oh, is it a quick one? Just a second. Microphone for you, madam. Quick answers. Quick answers, gentlemen. Quick answers.
It's linked to the last question in as much as what your attitude is to taking photographs. For me, a photograph, you know, paints 1,000 words, and I could capture feelings by taking a photograph. And I wondered if either of you did that.
I've got a whole kind of long-winded, complicated theory that I won't go into now about photographs sometimes being a way of avoiding thinking, feeling the emotions that a place gives you. Just standing on a mountain and seeing something like that and then trying to frame it in this little square. For me, that it doesn't do the job. And
he's
maybe
also,
words don't either.
A words man.
And this is where we diverge, because actually for me, the photograph, I can take thousands of photographs, and I can bore you originally with all my photographs, but for me, they are the additional note. When you can't remember how to describe a colour, that's for me, but that's two different writers doing two very similar jobs. Right, huge respect to my dear friend Nick.
Thank you, Harry.
You want both, I think. Absolutely fantastic. What were you going to say? Sorry.
I was going to say thank you very much to both of you for telling us about your books. And what a remarkable achievement for both of you to go so far and record it so accurately and interestingly. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Harry Bucknell, Nick Hunt and Tom Cheshire, everybody.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.